The following content contains adult subject matter, including sensitive material, and is intended for adult consumption only. It may not be suitable for all audiences. Therefore, discretion is advised.
Hey, everybody. It's Breaking Down, and I'm your host, Allie Colbert. And today on the show, we have Moshe Kasher. He's coming on to chat all about his book, Subculture Vulture. Really fucking interesting life this guy has had, like quite a life. He's brilliant. I love talking to him about growing up and being in AA early and his relationship with the rave scene and music being a child of deaf adults, his Jewishness. It's a beautiful, varied episode and really fascinating. He's so fun to talk to. You really can like learn a lot just listening to this guy. Just listening to this guy, you can learn a lot. So I hope you enjoy it. You can get his book now. It's out now, Subculture Vulture. Moshe is a hilarious stand-up comedian. I've worked with a bunch. And it's great. I'm chilling, you guys. I was thinking recently, I like Billie Eilish's music a lot. And I was thinking recently about how it's like a little bit strange that she records all that stuff with her brother. You know, like her and her brother are just jamming in her bedroom while she's like, and I'm a bad girl. And he's like, like it's a little... I don't know that I'd want that sibling relationship, but like it's getting her Grammys. That's it. I watched the new Wonka movie, Timothy Chalamet and Kylie Jenner. Like that still blows my mind. Like he's got to have a huge dick, right? That's all it is. Is that all it is? Is that like the subtext that he just has a huge cock? I think so. Okay. Enjoy the show. Email us breakingdown@spotify.com. Take a screenshot of yourself listening. Throw it up on your story. Go crazy. Subscribe. Email us. Just love us. Like, help us. Help me to help you.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Podcasting is just like a hand.
It is a hand. You're always podcasting.
This week, I'm definitely always podcasting.
What are you talking about?
This, the book.
Tell me all about the book.
You want the spiel?
Let's just do it. Just talk about the book for an hour and I'll listen.
Oh, God. It's funny because when you do these, like, you know, this book is like, that was the first thing that I sold, the first job I had in the pandemic. Do you remember the pandemic?
I remember it.
The whole fake thing that.
Yeah.
We all pretended to be down with, but really we agitated. And then we went to the Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah.
You remember.
You were there.
I was there.
I saw you.
It was so cool. We had kind of a meet cute there.
Do you remember? No, that was, yeah, I remember that.
It was cool because I was like, and then you were like.
You did comedy. You do comedy.
I did comedy there.
Yeah.
I was, you know that I did a set.
Yeah.
After Trump.
Yeah.
So the crowd was pretty agitated.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were like, can you calm them down and stuff? And I was like, oh, you don't come to me to calm them down, you know?
No, that's like, everyone's like, he'll rile them up.
I riled them up and with a, like, my, you know, my comedy's all about like free speech.
Yeah.
That's like the only thing that I've ever talked about, cancel culture. And
yeah,
free
no,
speech.
I wanted to talk about that with you also.
Oh, you were going to bring that up?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, fast forward. The pandemic, like...
They rioted to get you to stop performing.
Yeah, they hated this. It was such a bad...
They just fucking stormed the Capitol!
He was supposed to do 15 minutes!
He's blowing the light! Go in!
That would be a real harsh referendum on my comedy if people were like doing like Viking, you know, tree trunks to the Capitol windows to get away from one of my sets.
It would, wouldn't it be a great clip? Capitol gets stormed to stop comedian.
Yes. comedian destroys Capitol.
Yes.
Anyway, the pandemic, like, as I'm sure you felt the same thing, I was like, what am I going to do? I've been working on stages for, you know, 20 years and there are no stages. And then I sold this book. And it was like, it was the thing that I was like, okay, I'm going to be okay. Like, I'll be able to buy food for my little daughter.
Yeah.
And so the whole pandemic was spent like, you went to college, right?
I did go to college.
You remember that feeling where you were like in your dorm room, like with books stacked up and you're like pulling an all-nighter? I thought I was like done with that. But that was my whole pandemic, was just like research books arriving from Amazon, like stacking up higher and higher. And
what were you researching?
Well,
isn't this about your life?
It's about my life, but researching
your own life.
Yeah, I like Wikipedia'd myself. I called my mom and asked her to write a book and send it in to Amazon. Then I had to order it. We're not in direct contact. We've got like a social worker that we have to communicate through.
Yeah.
No, it is about my life. It's a memoir of my life, but it's also a history. It's through the lens of the six subcultures that have kind of defined my life and made me who I am. And so each section, it's called Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes. And each scene is a scene that kind of formed a little bit of the DNA that is me now. Mm-hmm. And those are AA and the 12 steps. When I was 15 years old, I got out of rehab for the last time, 15 years old. And I've been sober ever since. And for about 20 years, I was like a real fundamentalist, like AA member, right in the center of that world, specifically in the center of the world of young people's AA, which is like a subset of AA that people don't really know about. But I was 15 when I got sober, and I was the youngest person at every meeting I ever went to by a decade. And and I would go to young people's meetings, and the people there were like, they were elderly. They were like 25,
yeah,
26.
I mean, it was just you and Drew Barrymore.
That's right, me and Drew. And then at about 6 months, 9 months sober, I like decided I wanted to try to figure out how to have a bar mitzvah. Yeah, they give everybody an AA bar mitzvah. It's a really cool thing. They put you on a chair. You can't drink the Manischewitz. They bring you only Ketem wine.
I have to, okay, well, go into your subcultures and then I'll go into each subculture.
All right, so, okay.
There's too many, I need a chart.
So, well, there's a chart here. There's literally a chart.
Can I have it?
You can.
And then we'll put it back.
Did they send it to you? They didn't even send it
to
you.
They didn't send it to me.
Oh, well, you know what I'm going to do for you right now?
Give it to me.
I'm going to break it all down. So I went to AA, and I got sober when I was 15, and I spent a lot of my formative years there.
Yeah.
And then when I was about 9 months sober, I was like, I need a life. Like, I need to figure out how to, like, be a regular teenager and do teenage things. But my whole life up until that point was just, like, wannabe gangster, like, white boy identity crisis, getting high and tagging and breaking windows and getting arrested and going to mental hospitals. So that's no life. So I saw on a poll that there was a rave called Cyberfest 95, and I thought, I'm going to go to a rave. That's going to be my thing.
Okay.
And so I went by myself to this rave when I was 16 years old, and I walked into that first party and, like, had a full, clean and sober, a full molecular reconfiguration. Like, I was a different person when I walked out of that warehouse than I was when I walked in, and dedicated my 20s to that scene. I was a rave promoter and a DJ and an ecstasy dealer, clean and sober ecstasy dealer, for years. And then because of the rave scene, so that's scene two, of the rave scene, I heard that there was like a rave in the desert happening, and that we should go. And that was all I needed to go. I was such a crazy hardcore raver. Like, I would drive 6 hours on the rumor of a rave. So that's what I did. I jumped in my car. I drove with a bunch of other rave scumbags, and we paid $60 to get into Burning Man in 1996.
Oh my God.
When I was 16 years old. And last year I went to Burning Man for the 24th time. I've been going there since 96, and I used to work there. I was part of the infrastructure that put the event on for a long time. And then eventually I started stand-up comedy. And so that's Burning Man is scene three. Scene four is stand-up comedy, which we share, the world that we share, where we connect on that level. And then we're going to connect on this next level.
Tell me. Gay.
That's the epilogue. The epilogue is all of these subcultures. Honestly, there's not a lot gayer than raves and Burning Man.
Okay. Jewish.
Yes, I am Jewish.
Yes.
And my, not just Jewish, my father, when my mother left him, became like a born-again Hasidic Jew and was like in one of the most hardcore Hasidic Jewish communities called the Satmar Hasidim. And our family's from an even more hardcore sect called the Skver Hasidim, who do not, the women do not drive in New Square, New York. This is New York.
New York.
Women do not drive. There's not like sentries.
Yeah.
They won't stop you if you drove in.
Yes.
But the women there, they don't drive. They speak, everybody in my neighborhood growing up spoke Yiddish as a first language. And I—
But would, not in your, you grew up in the Bay Area.
Exactly. I would
I'm on my shit.
You are on your shit. Yeah, you're breaking it all down. But
I just blow my brains out.
And then I take over your podcast.
Welcome!
It's just, and then we just keep doing the podcast, but every single episode is me plugging my book years after it's come out. No one, the listenership dwindles to absolute, just your producer. You're right. I would spend 9 months a year, a regular secular kid in Oakland public schools, listening to hip hop and, you know, just a regular, fully regular California kid, no Jewish life whatsoever. I always say like, I have a simultaneously a much more and much less Jewish upbringing than all of my Jewish friends because I didn't go to camp and I didn't have like Jewish friends and I didn't have a Jewish identity. But 6 weeks a year, I would fly back to New York and cosplay as an extra on the set of Fiddler on the Roof and literally just live in a shtetl.
And that's when you're with your dad.
That's when I was with my dad.
Where is that area in New York? I only know Muncie.
So I got family in Muncie.
Okay.
Okay. I do have family in Muncie. Square is just outside of Muncie.
Okay. It's by like Monticello, New York.
I don't know. I only ever went to Muncie.
And okay.
It was like a dread. That was a dread drive for me.
Yeah.
Because I could feel the impending. They were nice. My family was nice. They were not mean, but they were, I mean, they were really intense. And when we would go to Square, I went to Square and I got a blessing from the Square Rebbe. Who's like the big man of Square.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting fact about Square.
Yeah.
Just to give you a taste of how intense that community is.
Uh-huh.
When Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
and you know who Hillary Clinton is.
I do.
Why didn't she pick
up the call? Vince Foster.
She is who we were trying to stop that day I did my epic set that ended in a riot. When Hillary Clinton was running for senator of New York,
mm-hmm.
100% of citizens of New Square, New York, or close enough to it that it statistically doesn't matter, voted for Hillary Clinton. In an unrelated story, Bill Clinton pardoned one of the elders in the New Square community for a Pell Grant scandal a year after that. So this is how, that's what a Rebbe is, right?
Yeah.
A rabbi, but you know, a rabbi can give you advice. A Rebbe can say, we're voting for Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
Okay. So that is scene five. And The other, and these are the less of the sceney scenes of the last two. They're more of the what I was born into. My mother, my father, the Hasidic one, my stepmother, my stepsister, my half sister, my half brothers, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, everybody is deaf. The whole family's deaf.
What is growing up with two deaf parents like?
Well, I'll tell you, what was good about it was when I started DJing, I could like practice. Like full on, full volume, just like there was a rave going on in my house every day. My mom was just like doing the dishes and whistling. And, well, she didn't whistle, but you get the idea. She didn't care. Well, growing up with deaf parents is like, you know, people always ask me that question. And it's, I don't have an answer because it's, I mean, what was it like growing up with hearing parents? I've never had that experience. And it's the only thing I ever knew. I can tell you the parts that like stick out, which are that, you know, I love my mother and my dad and I'm super fiercely proud of the deaf community and the fact that I'm a member of it and the fact that I'm fluent in sign language and the crazy journey that the deaf community has gone through. I'll tell you about that if you have time. But I also grew up and was very embarrassed that my mother talked funny and that people would turn and look when I'd walk, when she'd speak, and I'd never wanted her to come see me at school. And like, that was, you know, and I have this memory of pulling up to a like ranger station at a campground and the ranger like reaching over my mother to hand me the campground paperwork and say, can your mother read? And she's like driving the car. It's
right.
Like, yeah, she can, you know, she can, she's driving. What do you thought she was? What, she doesn't know what stop means? Like, just hand her the thing. Like, so there was a lot of that shame and pride all kind of weirdly mixed in, you know?
Yeah.
My brother is not deaf and my maternal grandmother isn't, but everybody going down the line is deaf. And I was born into that world.
Are you deaf?
I am Only in my hip hop spirit.
Yeah.
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 But I was a sign language interpreter for 15 years. I signed before I could talk. And I'm a member of the deaf community. I can say that. As one of the guys that blurbed the book said, Nal DeMarco, who's himself deaf, and he's like the America's Top Model. Do you remember him?
Mm-mm.
Like a super hunky deaf guy. He wrote a book called Deaf Utopia.
Oh, I know that book.
Yeah. Do you really?
No, I do. I've heard that.
So this is high praise, I think. He says, all seen through the unique lens of a culturally deaf individual who also happens to be hearing.
Mm.
And that's like who I am. Not who I am. That's who CODAs are, children of deaf adults. We are in this very strange way, like it's like being born white in Wakanda. You know, it's like we're there and we're a member of the community, but we're also a member of the opposition party, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I was born in that world. I signed before I could talk. And all of those six universes have been really foundational, kind of like building blocks to who I am.
My God, you are more fascinating than any male comedian I've ever spoken to.
At least I think I'm fascinating because I wrote a whole freaking book about it.
That's so interesting. That's so many lives.
It is a lot of lives.
I can't imagine them all converging, but they converge in you.
I think I didn't even quite know what the through line was.
Yeah.
Because I knew that I lived in these kind of disparate, separate worlds that had all been so unbelievably meaningful to me. But I was like, what's the through line? And the through line at the end of the book, I look and realize is very obvious. The through line is me. I am the connective tissue between these worlds. And they synthesize in this way that it feels like they don't go together. But for me, they go together perfectly. They fit in this. And I think if I have anything philosophical to say in the book, it's mm-hmm. that like everybody's lives is, at least from my generation, is this. Your life is this like pinball game where you don't know where you're headed and you never have any clue. Everything feels like kind of chaos. And you're just like slamming from thing to thing. Mine are a little more extreme.
Yeah.
But then you get a little bit older and you look back and you realize everything is, it's like destiny in reverse. I don't really believe in destiny, but I believe in destiny in the rearview mirror. Like you look back and you go, whoa, this was the path that I was on, and it led me to here. It led me to, you. It led me to not being able to actually park in the Spotify parking lot and get my parking validated. But who knows? I could walk outside and I could, I could meet my second wife. You just don't know. Like everything is this weird road less traveled.
I totally agree. It's my favorite. When people ask me what's the best advice I've ever heard, I think about Steve Jobs in his commencement speech. I think it was for Chicago University of the Arts when he says you can only connect the dots retrospectively.
That's it.
And
yes. You're giving me Jobs bumps over here.
No, so it's true. So whatever it is that you're choosing to believe in to kind of lead you, whether that is destiny or fate or your gut or whatever, faith, I do feel that. Obviously, we're meaning-making machines. And we can look back and say, well, this and this and this. But it all makes sense looking back.
The explanation, if you're a believer in destiny
mm-hmm.
or God or universe made this, I was headed there. Or you're a materialist and you go, no, this was random. Neither are less breathtaking. They're both equally unbelievable. If you had a force that was driving you towards where you're supposed to go, that's an unbelievable thing. It means that your pain and your suffering and your triumph and your glory, all of it has meaning. And if it has no meaning, it's equally breathtaking. It's like, you mean to tell me that all of these things that we experience in life that lead us to where we are going just happen through complete ripples in the pond, timeline of randomness. And then I meet my wife and then I divorce my wife. And then all of this stuff is random. That to me is also beautiful and breathtaking and amazing.
That's beautiful. You keep bringing up divorcing your wife.
No, that is true. I realized as soon as I ripped it twice.
Yeah.
I'm in a very, very troubled marriage right now. And I didn't want to bring it up, but it seems like I'm going to be doing that.
The nothingness of that makes me, I think I'm even more affected by that. That kind of makes me
cry. You think it's more beautiful?
That it's all nothing?
That's really sad. It's sad, but if this is nothing, if this is random, every time I start getting into this waxing philosophical, imagine the person rolling their eyes.
Who cares?
Then
they're not our listener.
That's so true. You should log off. Actually, don't. Actually, subscribe to the Patreon.
Subscribe to the page.
Because subscribe to the Patreon for sure.
Follow.
But then log the fuck off and go get a spirit of positivity in your life. But I think there's something yes, it's sad if everything is just a careening sort of ball of nothing slamming from wall to wall. But it's also that's wild that randomness could create this kind of beauty. I mean, that's the universe, right? I feel like, okay, anyway, but that's the universe.
Yeah.
The universe sort of just all of a sudden there was a weird chemical reaction and there was a big bang that just hurled all of the material in the universe was contained in a pinhead worth of density, infinite density. And then that created San Francisco and baguettes and Paris and your podcast and Mars and—
And subculture vulture.
And subculture vulture.
Do you think that the universe, like, we're getting off, but the universe is created because of the big bang or whatever. And then obviously the sun's going to burn out. Everyone's going to die. Everything explodes. And then that just keeps repeating and there's no beginning or end to time. And this is just kind of this iteration of life.
You mean that eventually all the stuff folds back into the little pinprick and that we all begin again?
Yeah.
Well, there is this idea that, do I believe that? I have no fucking idea. No, I don't.
That was my first question for you.
I'm sorry. I got us off track. Let's start with the material death of the universe and what happens next.
It's just like, I don't think there's really a beginning and end to time.
Well, you know, this is gonna fuck your butt.
Let's fucking go.
Let's do this. I found out that, and this is not something I learned because I'm smart. I heard a podcast and a guy came on my podcast called Sean Carroll. He's a theoretical physicist.
Mm-hmm.
That for all intents and purposes, space, that is, if you, you know, jump up high enough and you get into the cold darkness of space where Mars lives, and time, that is, you know, the thing that made your grandma be born and then eventually die.
Mm-hmm.
If your grandma's dead, if she's not, may she live to be 120,
mm-hmm.
Is the same thing. Space, you know, they always say space-time. They say that on purpose because space and time are inextricably linked. They're basically the same thing. And that, does that make—
How is that?
We're getting into the area where I should say I'm just a comedian and an author.
Not totally clear on how that is.
Well, you know, that idea like, oh, well, what happened before the Big Bang?
Right.
And people say that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, the Bible says it was chaos and void,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Tohu vavohu. It's a wrong question to say what happened before the Big Bang,
mm-hmm.
because there was no before, because time began when the Big Bang went pop, right?
Right.
So that time and space as the universe, the universe expanding is a physical manifestation representation
of time.
Of what time is. And so it's the same thing in this crazy fucked up way.
Whoa, you should start asking people, what space is it?
Yeah, what space you got?
What space you got?
Oh, no. Oh, it's already sorry. Andromeda. I can't do this. I'm late.
Okay, that's trippy.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I'm going to try and move us through the subcultures of your life.
Let's do this.
Okay. You grew up in the Bay Area.
Yes.
By 15, you're in AA.
By 15, actually.
Or you're leaving rehab, you said?
The truth is, by 15, I went to AA and said, help. I already was in AA because I started going to rehab. I'm from that generation. I was raised in the wake of the Just Say No, Nancy Reagan, the rehab generation.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody, that was the beginning of let's medicate every kid, let's send every troubled kid to rehab, let's send them to Utah and have them like have an ex-Marine scream in their face and then hand them a pickaxe and say this is the road to manhood. Like that's the universe and the generation that I come from. And so I went to rehab for the first time when I was 13. Like a year into drinking and getting high, because that was the answer for parents of that time. Like, send the kid to rehab. Nancy Reagan says it. Let's fucking go. They would say. Even
did you need it? Were you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was going
it.
On?
This is one of the questions that I ask in the book. Now I'm 44,
mm-hmm.
right? And now I'm looking back and I go, was I a drug addict? Like, is that what that was, or was it just a manifestation of? Like all the chaos that had been that my life was and then it came out in the form of like a wild, like, you know, sort of druggy boy. Like what I can say is this. I've worked with with teenagers a lot. As a sign language interpreter, I would go to like middle schools and work with kids that were my age. And I always had this like, I have a very interesting relationship with like adolescence, teenage adolescence, because it's like these are really primal, foundational years for me, but I guess for everybody else. And I would work at a middle school, I would like look at the kids and I would go, are they like, was I like that? And mm-hmm. the answer is like, no, I was really fucked up. I was really a wild, fucked up kid. So I had something more than I think a normal teenager, for sure. I was,
yeah.
But was I, did I need rehab? I needed something. And that was the form that the something took.
Where was the edge from you coming from? Were you, was your, were your parents happy at that time, or they had already split, or?
No, I, no, nobody was happy. nobody was happy. I was born in a family on the edge, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, and my mom.
And you're an only child? At that
no, I have a brother.
Oh, you have a brother.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Your brother becomes a rabbi, right?
My brother, yeah, he's in here. He's in this subculture over here somewhere. Yeah.
Okay.
Brother rabbi, son, other brother comedian.
Is he going hard in the paint, like as a kid?
Currently, or as a rabbi, he goes very hard in the paint.
Yeah.
He, he's like one of the hardest in the paint rabbis.
Uh-huh.
But the paint is blue and white.
Got it.
Does my brother become like me?
Is your, are you like the black sheep at that time?
I'm the identified patient, as they would say in the therapy that I was force-fed from the time I was 4 years old.
Wow.
I was the identified patient. My brother would always, it was so funny because it was like, my brother would always be like, dude, why don't you just, he's like, our parents are deaf. Like, you can get away with murder if you just chilled out a little bit. He's like, you're getting caught all the time. And then I would say to him, you don't even know how much shit I'm doing. I never get caught, statistically.
Yeah.
The amount you think, I get caught only when I get caught. I'm doing shit all the time.
What are you doing?
Oh, you know, drugs-wise or just
behavior-wise? I don't know. I just want to get paint a picture of what you're
up
to.
What kind of drugs were you
doing? Well, I know you said you're drinking, but what is the bad shit you're doing?
Well, violence.
Violence, war.
War. I was involved in some paramilitary stuff.
Wow. Okay.
Regular juvenile delinquent stuff,
yeah.
Like getting arrested all the time, tagging, fighting, gang shit that was fake gang. You know, like here's a cool thing about being like white and being in a gang.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know this.
No, I don't.
You could just be a gang. There's no board. There's no, you don't have to apply. You don't have to pass anything. You just be like, be a gang. So we decided we were a gang one day.
You just be a gang.
It was the most pathetic group. I mean, here's the real reality.
Yeah.
I was from this set of circumstances where my parents are deaf and my dad's this Jewish guy. My parents hate each other and they tell my dad that, you know, my mom tells me that my dad loves me less than my brother because I don't know what. And she starts sending me to therapy when I'm four. And, you know, we're poor, raised on welfare, and I'm one of the lone white boys in Oakland Public School. All these things are things that, a set of circumstances that is a weird backdrop for mm-hmm. a life. But like, they don't explain why I became the way I became, because my brother had the same set of circumstances and he found a way to just like be okay, be a straight A student and kind of go soft in the paint.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I felt like painfully alone and different and never felt like I fit in and never felt like, part of it was my mom telling me that. Like she started to see in the very beginning that I was this wild kid and she started shunting me to therapy like almost immediately. And so then you get this feedback loop where the therapist is telling you there's something wrong with you, learning disabilities, psychological disorders. I was diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, ADHD, depression, you know.
Oh my God, everything.
Everything that you would give a kid like that. And then I found these, you know, I stole a pack of Camel Wides one day and this guy saw me stealing them or saw me smoking them outside of the Safeway or whatever and was just like, what's up, dude? You seem cool. You smoke. That's sick. Come to the back of the portables and meet the other derelicts. And so I went to the back of the portables and got high with them for the first time. And like, that was the first time I didn't feel that feeling of painful difference, painful separation.
Yeah.
I was like, I have found the other broken toys of Oakland and I feel okay.
Right.
And the problem with that is, you know, when you're, you know, getting high is the first thing that's ever made you feel okay and you're 12, 13 years old, there was no part of me that was developed enough to say, let me take this easy. I like jumped in and by the time I was 15, I had just gone so hard that it had dried up.
Yeah, I mean, it's you don't know how to learn how to self-soothe. That's how you're regulating your nervous system as like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't even self-soothing in the most classic way until a year after that. I mean, this is literally pre-pubescent.
Yeah, that's, it's crazy.
It is wild.
So when you then get clean or sober, whatever you want to call it, I don't know what you're saying.
The thing works.
You know what I mean?
It all works.
Like, do you then feel like you're acting out less, or are you attributing it to that? Or is it that when you find like music and this rave scene, then that's like really kind of like supporting you?
Well, it was a kind of a 1-2 punch, actually. I got out of rehab because I had this like realization, which was and by the way, the book takes you through the journey of me getting sober. It starts the day I get sober. Mm-hmm. My last book, Casher in the Rye, mm-hmm. kind of ends the day before I get sober. Mm-hmm. So this is what happened next.
Okay.
And I walked into a meeting, a young people's meeting, and I raised my hand and I was like, I need help. And then I got up and I walked out of the room, which is like kind of a classic way to ask for help. You're like, I need some help. And if you can offer it, I'll be out in the hallway just chilling, shooting dice or whatever. But this guy like followed me outside and his name was Pigeon. And he put his arms around me, older guy. I mean, you know, I thought he was older. I think he was probably 27. And he was like, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And that's not like high level advice. That does not have the profundity of space and time are the same thing. And do you think that at the material death of the universe, it will just recreate itself? It's pretty like low level.
Yeah.
It's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's not even, he's not even trying.
Yeah, there's not much for you to grab onto there.
But I did. I like grabbed onto it. It was like enough. It was just like somehow this guy like wrapping his arms around me and hugging me. I just was like,
everyone needs a pigeon.
Everybody needs a pigeon. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
And then I walked back in the meeting and I like started putting together days. Like that was like day one. And you know, they start by telling you like the most, again, everything's base level. One day at a time, mm-hmm. right? Is like the classic, you know, axiom of AA. But it's like, it's powerful, actually. Since space is so infinite and the universe is expanding forever, you go, I can't stay sober. I can't do this. I'm incapable of this. But somebody goes, okay, what about just, can you do it? Can you wait till tomorrow? You go, yeah, I can fucking wait till tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's not the issue. The issue is my life is so unbelievably painful. Like, I can't live in this world without, like, this medicine. And they go, yeah, but just till tomorrow, you could go to bed tonight without getting high. I go, yes, motherfucker, I could do that. But you're not listening to the problem.
Yeah.
I go, well, just go to bed. You get high tomorrow. I go, really? You get high tomorrow? I was like, oh, AA rules. I didn't know you could get high tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then you do it. You stay sober until you go to bed. And then you wake up and you go, fuck yeah, I'm ready. It's tomorrow. And they go, oh, wait, no, it's tomorrow. Today again. No! And then you just start putting together these days. And then a day becomes a month and a month becomes 3 months and 3 months becomes 9 months. And then you buy a ticket to Cyberfest. And anyway, what I'm trying to say is like, I started these building blocks of like, you know, getting my rage under control, getting the acute status of just being an out of control, like psychological, like miscreant. Mm-hmm. That started to heal in AA just by doing the stuff that they told me to do. But I had this other part of me that was like super unhealed that I didn't realize till I walked into that rave. I walked into that first party and I was in line. I remember I had Escape. How old are you?
You're 30.
30. Do you remember Escape? It might have been.
No.
It's a cologne by Calvin Klein.
And okay.
I believe it was unisex. I believe.
Oh, a lot that of was those CK were unisex. Yeah, CK1's unisex.
CK1 was the classic unisex. Remember when that blew people's minds? People were like, how could it be unisex? It cannot be. Like fast forward 30 years, like,
I couldn't
the
believe
non-binary
that I could wear
revolution.
That.
Like we couldn't even deal with a cologne that anyone could spray on themselves. It's no wonder people are having a hard time with gender deconstruction.
For boy and girl?
Yeah, it cannot be. A boy smells like truck and oil. A girl smells like flour. Flowers.
Flour.
Flour.
A girl smells like petal.
It's because baking. No, flowers. Yeah. Flowers. So, yes, yeah. Petal. Flowers. Anyway, I had this Escape bottle and I remember I was in line. I'm by myself. And I start stuffing the Escape bottle into a sock. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, kind of swinging it around. Like, this is the mindset that I have. And by the way, I hope I'm not giving the impression that I was a gangster. I was pathetic wannabe gangster. Yeah, like, I had a Scarface.
You made that clear.
Okay, good. I never want people to think, like, I remember myself as, like, I guess who I was like Tony Montana kind of a thing. I guess that was me. Kind of an Al Capone of the prepubescent white boy set. So I'm like, okay, I got this Escape sock. Like, that's my mind. I'm like, there might be my ops. My ops might be in there. This is pre-ops. They didn't say ops. My foe. I had enemies, but like, I don't know what I thought I would find in there that would necessitate like a potpourri-scented blackjack. But I get into the party. So that's just my mind that I bring in. Mind in line is like weapon. I get into the party and it's like, this, like, I can't even put myself back in that kind of that level of explosion, mental explosion. I walk in and I'm just like, what am I looking at? Who am I looking at? Who are these people? There's like people in Cat in the Hat hats, like flopping around and glow stick, you know, spinning. And there's like rave music and lasers and trippy visuals and everybody's dancing. And I start dancing. Like until that point, like I wouldn't dance. I would like kind of do one of these. Cause you know, like when you're like a white wannabe, like when it comes to dancing, you will prove your whiteness. You're two left feet.
Right. You're not going to let yourself seen like that.
So you sit on the side and you're like, you just kind of, yeah. And all of a sudden I get into this warehouse and I'm fucking pirouetting. I'm like doing Baryshnikov spins, you know. And I put the bag down with my escape weapon. It's gone. I never saw it again. Never wore escape again. This like gay couple comes up to me. These two guys grab me around the waist and they pick me up into the air and they're like, you dance beautifully. And I'm like, oh shit. Like these gay dudes hugging me, telling me I'm beautiful. Oh, they don't know who I am. I'll let them know who I am. They let me down. I grabbed them and pulled them close to me, kissed them both on the cheek. I was like, you guys dance beautifully too. And I like pirouetted off into the crowd. Like, I'm telling you, it was like AA was a slow burn. And it was maybe a more profound burn of developing this new me. But Raves was like, slam. Like, I'm a different human being from when I walked into this building to when I walked out. I was changed. I walked out, I burned all my Fila gear, I bleached my hair blonde, I started putting glitter in my hair, wearing barrettes, and got JNCO jeans. I just was like, this is me. I am this man now. And both of them, weirdly, started with someone coming and just putting their arms around me. Those two guys. Pigeon.
Yeah.
I just needed a fucking hug.
Yeah, you just needed a hug. Do you think going into that space, it's like, it's seeing people that are just letting themselves be like free, like it's the music, people, because when you're dancing, you don't have an agenda, really.
Yeah.
You're just moving your fucking ass.
Yep.
And you don't feel judged.
I think that's 100% what it was. It was like my whole social life was like all about being like bound by codes of like, we look hard and, you know, or and I don't want anybody to see that I'm like, adore. I remember I used to, when I was a little kid, when I would look in the mirror, I would make faces at myself because I was so wound up and so like, and on psychiatric medication and drugs, but like I would make these like crazy, it started to make me feel like I really was as crazy as all the therapists were saying I was.
Yeah.
But now I realize like I was just this like coiled spring of tension and resentment. And then I get to the Raves, it's exactly what you're saying. People were fucking going nuts and free. And not only free, they were, did you ever go to Raves?
Yeah,
I
did.
You know how everybody's like kind of dressed like a child?
Yeah.
Like, it's a little silly, and it's part of what people laugh at about Raves. I mean, I get that Raves are a little silly, but that was, and it took me years to realize this, that was like exactly what I needed. Yes, there was sex and drugs and dancing all night, but there was also like this weird mystical infantilization where I'm wearing a barrette and I'm wearing a pacifier and I used to bring this monkey puppet to Raves with me and I would like dance around with the monkey puppet. Mm-hmm. I was like, I realized years after that, like, oh yeah, I missed my whole childhood.
Yeah, you're finally getting permission to play.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right.
That's the time, the chronology of your childhood is like so disjointed.
It was just super arrested here. And this was all super adult stuff. And then all of a sudden I get into this, you'd think really adult world, everybody was on drugs.
Yeah.
But it was also this very innocent experience of like, just like you said, people being free. And like, I found that freedom there. Like AA and Raves are like, to me, like inextricably linked to me becoming like the person that I am and the comedian that I am. Like it just unlocked me as a human being. And it swung me over to this crazy pendulum where I was like a little absurd to eventually like swing back to the middle, which is just like me.
Yeah. And you still go to Burning Man.
I do still go to Burning Man.
What is that like for you? I mean, is it your relationship with raves now is different or?
I haven't been to a rave proper. I don't even know if what they are anymore, honestly. Like
like music festivals?
Well, well, that's what happened was that, you know, I started throwing parties in the 90s and we threw like the first party in San Francisco where we had two of the headliners were Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash. And then that was new.
Okay.
Although hip hop and rave music used to be very, they started linked. There was a kind of music called hip house, which is like people rapping over house beats.
Uh-huh.
Like eventually rave went its own way. And then we started throwing this party where there would be like acts from other genres, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, this is pure speculation, that that was the beginning of the like kind of festivalification of electronic dance music, where you would go, oh, this doesn't just belong in a weird underground warehouse. This could belong at Coachella. This could belong at a stadium. It was the beginning of the evolution of like dance music becoming like on the radio in a big way. It was always on the radio in Europe and stuff, but like to become like stadium acts and festivals. But Burning Man had this different thing going on. Like, when I went to Burning Man for the first time, like I said, I just thought I was going to a rave. When I got there, it was like, oh, this is, I don't know what this is, but it isn't a rave. It's something else. We got there and I remember we pulled up. There was just a naked guy selling tickets. And he's like, reset your tripometer. When you'd get to the 8 mile mark, turn right. And we're like, what happened? And he's what happens then? He's like, you'll see it. I go, well, what if we don't see it? He's like, then you'll be lost in the desert. Burning Man was way more wild then.
Yeah.
And by the end of that weekend, people were dead. Somebody got run over, got his head cut off in a game of chicken. Friends of mine from the rave scene got run over in their tent and were like permanently disfigured and disabled. Buildings were getting set on fire right on like the raw desert. There were drive-by shooting ranges. I mean, it was fucking insane.
That's nuts.
It was truly nuts. For me, it was another experience of like walking through a portal and going, oh, I'm this now. Like,
yeah.
I want to do this forever. And what that thing gave me was this like, raves kind of started it, but Burning Man like sealed it, which is this feeling of like, I want to be around people that are fucked up and weird and different and don't follow rules and live on the margins of society. And, you know, they say like Burning Man used to be a place where weird people would go to feel normal. And now it's more of a place where normal people go to feel weird.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of what's happened there. I still go and I still love it, but it definitely has become a more sort of sanitized version of the weird thing I stepped into 25 years ago.
Yeah. There's some weird like rhetoric around Burning Man of like, you're not the same. Like when you go, you leave a different person. Or like if you can survive those days. And I'm like, what is happening? But like, it's a barter system, isn't it? Is that what people say?
People love to talk about the barter system. Although there is no barter system. That's really never been true. What's true is that they don't sell anything there. So unlike other festivals, like you can't get a corn dog from a local vendor.
So it's a barter system, man.
You got to barter for that dog. You got to go to a man making corn dogs and say, how many beads will it take for me to get? So things are
20
free.
Minutes with my wife, dude.
Now you're bringing it up.
I know.
And that's the problem. That's the reason it's on my mind is because of a 20 minute for my wife situation for a corn dog at Burning Man 2018. It was a very bad mistake.
I was hungry.
I regret every day that I ate that corn dog.
Do you camp? Do you camp there, right?
I camp there. I've gone from my first year there was in a tent showering by like pushing a knife into a 2 gallon bottle of water and going like this, cooking like Dinty Moore chili on a Sterno stove. And now I own an RV. That could have been a subculture. I own an RV and I have a little home that I bring every year.
How many nights do you go there?
I used to go for a month because I used to work there. And so I would
That's too much.
You think? Yeah, I know.
Wild.
It is wild. And what was really funny and wild about it was I started to become a professional stand-up in those years. And I would tell my agents, like, hey, no work for me for the month of August because I will be working as, like, a psychedelic security guard at Burning Man. And they'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, because in Hollywood, it can be like this is the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And there was something about, like, just going to Burning Man and, like, getting just dirty and climbing into vehicles to search them for stowaways that made me feel like I was a real person on some level, that I wasn't just this like Hollywood beast. And so I loved it. And I did
that. It was security you were doing there?
Well, I worked for a department called The Gate. And this is where the comedy part of me kind of fits into my Burning Man world. Because raves are like all plur. You know about plur?
No.
That's the rave credo. It's peace, love, unity, and respect.
Okay, sure.
And it's and the ironic twist is, of course, it's very difficult to respect someone who's screaming plur over techno beats, you know? But that was our, like, credo. Raves were, like, very hippie and very love and very positive and good vibes only, mm-hmm. right? Burning Man has a really different origin story. It starts off it actually literally starts with LSD. And the acid revolution that changed the 60s, which shot people out into like 1,000 different directions. Some were hippies, some were yippies, some were like Ram Dass, Two Non Turn In Dropout. And then Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters were like, well, let's go just fuck shit up. Let's just go be weird. And that's what they did. They got into a bus and they just started traveling around the country, having these like weird, random experiences. And that led to a group called the Suicide Club, which was in San Francisco. A group of artists had this secret society where they would like climb to the top of the Golden Gate Bridge and have high tea, or like, infiltrate the American Nazi Party, or, you know, they do these like weird like events like that were weird and offbeat, but only for them. Nobody else could know about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that spun into this group called the Cacophony Society, which was, they wanted to do the same thing. They called it culture jamming. And they invented things like SantaCon.
Mm-hmm.
Without Cacophony Society, there is no SantaCon.
Oh, wow.
They invented things like SantaCon, for those that don't know, is the annual festival of like white bros who vomit in bars in Santa Claus outfits.
Yeah.
They invented things like Billboard Liberation. You know, the Billboard Liberation front. If you ever see like a billboard that's been like exactly recreated, but mm-hmm. it's with a subversive message, that's them. Flash mobs, that's them. Without Cacophony Society.
Oh, wow, they got their hand in all these pots.
All these like weird, they called the culture jamming pots, right? So that was the difference between them and the Suicide Club. Was that everybody was welcome. They would do it in public. They wouldn't do it for themselves.
Right. It was performance art pieces.
They were performance art. So that you would go, what the fuck was that? You'd be walking down the street and see one of their famous pranks is like, you get on a bus, you're on a bus, and all of a sudden a clown gets on the bus. And you're like, okay, clown, interesting. And then the next stop, another clown gets on the bus. Or two clowns. And then all the way through San Francisco, all of a sudden you're on a bus, there's 70 clowns. You're like,
that's
what
great.
The fuck is happening? And you're going, that moment of magic of you not knowing what's happening, of them jamming your life, that's what the Cacophony Society was about. At the same time, a guy named Larry Harvey started burning a statue of a man, because it was in the air doing weird things. He started burning a statue of a man on Baker Beach in San Francisco. And that event started to become an annual event. It got bigger and bigger and bigger until the cops shut it down. And the Cacophony Society went to Larry Harvey and said, if you want a place to burn this thing, we know a spot in the desert where there's no rules and there's nobody watching and there's no cops. If you just drive, follow us 6 hours into Nevada, we can do whatever the fuck we want. And that's how Burning Man started. This guy, Michael, AKA Danger Ranger, drew a line in the dirt in the desert and said, when you walk over this line, you come into another zone, a temporary autonomous zone is what they called it. Anyway, I say all that to say that culture jamming spirit was where my comedy part mm-hmm. started to be able to be expressed, like the much more cynical, much more like fuck shit up kind of part of me, because I'm still swinging from the pendulum of positivity, violence over here. I landed in the middle of like what you are, a shit talking like comedian who like likes to make fun of things. And so that was really big in Burning Man for a long time. And that spirit has really dwindled. But things like pranks and making fun of people in a hopefully participatory way was like a big part of Burning Man and the world that I lived in. And all of those people ended up working in one department called The Gate, where we would search all the cars. It was like the the TSA of Burning Man. It was like not quite magic like inside and not quite like banal like the regular world. We were the first people you saw, and we would search your car. And that doesn't sound like prank making fun, but dude, we used to have so much fun. We used to like, we would bring like a vacuum out and pretend we were vacuuming the desert, but we took the filter out and turn it toward, if anybody pulled up in like a brand new like Lexus, the absurdity of that was such that we would turn the vacuum and we would be pretending that we were hard at work, and we'd be like shunting in like a 320 PSI like plume of dust into their
car. Are they getting a kick out of this?
No!
It's just for you guys.
It's kind of for him. We're jamming. Like, that particular prank, I think they didn't really get a kick out of.
That is so funny.
But there were other things we would do. Like, we had this art car called The Void. Like, mm-hmm. there's art cars are a big thing at Burning Man. I'm sure you've seen them.
Yes, I've seen that. And also, aren't there, like, tribes? Bands? What, are there the groups that you have to like join to be like, I've heard people be like, oh, I'm in the Brothers.
Oh, you mean theme camps?
I mean theme camps.
That's what you mean. And yes, there are theme camps, and the theme camps can vary wildly. Like, you know, they can go all the way from like a really lo-fi, like there was a stand-up camp this year, and they built a pretty cool comedy club, and then they would just have shows, and that was their theme camp.
Oh, that's
There's one that's like a as if a hotel, and every night they hold a raffle. They have like luxury tents and themed rooms, and you can win a night in that room.
It's so creative.
It's super creative and super fun, and but sometimes it's not creative. Some of the camps are just like, you know, Elon Musk and like, you know, other billionaires that have paid like $80,000 to have like a fully curated experience where like sex workers and cocaine and like sushi is flown into them. It goes all over the place, right?
Yeah. So how old are you when you, at that point, when you start kind of finding comedy?
I was 21, I think, the first time I did comedy.
And where is that you're doing it?
I was in a semester abroad and it got cut short. I'd been going to college and to community college. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I was starting to like write. I always wanted to be a writer when I was a little kid. I never was like, I'm going to be a comedian. I was like, I'm going to be a writer. I started to write these like long form monologues, like Eric Bogosian and Spalding Gray. What did you want to do?
Well, I wanted to be a stand up.
Always.
Weird. I really wanted to be a stand up. I loved Wanda Sykes, and I remember. I love Seinfeld. I saw Jesus is Magic when I was like in eighth grade. And I was like, I want to be a stand-up comedian. I started doing stand-up at NYU.
Oh, cool.
And
I think that's not uncommon. I think it's about like 50-50. I think 50% of comedians, I knew that they were going to do this when they were little kids.
It's strange. But then some other people, they just stumble into it.
Well, Sarah is in my stumble.
Sarah's in your stumble.
Yeah, Jesus is Magic is in there because... I was writing these like really like emotional long form monologues. I have this monologue published about a young kid who gets like an HIV diagnosis and is like grappling. I mean, if that got out, my career is over. But it got published. Like I was starting to have a little bit of positive feedback about that. But I didn't want to be an actor. Did I want to be I thought maybe I'll be like Eric Bogosian, like monologist guy. I didn't know. I went to the semester abroad and it got cut short. And due to like political stuff, and I thought, well, I'll go to New York and because I have nothing to do. My school doesn't start up again. This is 2001 or two, I think, maybe.
Okay.
My school doesn't start up until September because they've cut this short. And Chelsea Peretti was there and she I had kept in touch with because we went to middle school together and she went to my brother's high school. And I'd seen her one person show and we used to study improv together in her basement when we were kids. So maybe on some level I knew I wanted something in the performance, but I didn't know. And she was like, I do stand up now. And I was just like, you do what? What do you mean? Like, I didn't know stand up. I knew like Eddie Murphy. I knew Janine Garofalo's half hour HBO comedy half hour. I thought like that was cool, but I was not like, I just had no idea what she was talking about. And she took me to this show called Eating It at, I can't remember where. It's in the book, but Patrice O'Neill was there, was on the lineup, and Sarah Silverman was on the lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And I, again, this is another moment where it was just like a railroad switch in my destiny. I had never seen anything like that. I couldn't believe what they were doing. Like, it was so, like, horrifying, like, transgressive, I mean.
Yeah.
I remember Patrice was making fun of Michael J. Fox. He had just gotten his Parkinson's diagnosis. He was making fun of it. And I was like, you're not. You can't. Like, my mind there was like, you can't do that. But another part of my mind was like, you can just do jokes for that. That's the only goal is like making fun. And I was like, whoa, like a changed person. But this was a 1-2 punch because then the next night Chelsea had her own show with Bobby Tisdale. And I went and saw her do stand up and she was great and she killed it. And I was like, wait, I know you. Like, you're not those titans that I saw last night. You're not Sarah Silverman, Patrice O'Neill, people that I didn't know but I knew were a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You're like a person to me.
Yeah.
And that sent me. Like, I was like, okay, when you come to San Francisco for vacation, I'll have written 5 minutes of material and will you take me to an open mic? And she said yes, and she did. And that was, my destiny was like sealed at that point.
Whoa. That's, I felt that way about Patrice.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him at the comic strip when people were like auditioning.
Uh-huh.
And he was like judging it.
Uh-huh. That
and
sounds fun.
He was so, he was just eviscerating people.
The probably the most like talented eviscerator in comedy history.
Yeah.
Maybe in world history. Maybe we could take him out of.
I mean, he terrified me. And I was terrified of going to the cellar because of that. Because
right.
He was at the back table just killing people.
Yes.
And I was terrified to even walk in the olive tree. I'm still scared to go into the olive tree,
sure.
Even though I've been there 5 years. I'm still terrified.
I mean, but I am too.
Patrice, I remember at the comic strip, and I was telling this to Bonnie McFarlane, when she came on the show, there was a comedian in New York that feels very gay and says he's straight.
Uh-huh.
And he auditioned. And Patrice just said, "Do you know that you're gay?" and he was like, "I'm not gay." And he's like, "You can't get passed because you don't know that you're gay. And you're never going to be funny until you realize that you're gay." And
that
then he just
so
left.
So funny. And horrifying.
Horrifying. I mean, it was amazing, though. And I felt that with Joan Rivers all
yes,
the time
Joan
growing
Rivers
up.
Joan Rivers definitely had that same energy.
Where I was
sure.
like, "I can't believe you're saying this."
Well, that's the thing that it was like watching Patrice and Sarah is like they had taken a sword and stabbed into the middle of the thing that I had been like gussying up with like confessional monologue.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, we can just get rid of all that crap. And in the middle is like the kernel of funny. And what's interesting about that, because like I said, every one of these sections is a history of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Is that is what happened with stand-up too. Stand-up used to be, stand-up comes from, you know, farce. And like, you know, theatrical performances and then, you know, Gus, like you'd be in a costume and you'd be have a set. And then someone figured out in America, we could get rid of everything. We could just crack out the set and the costume and the script and just take the person and put that person alone on a stage.
That
and
feels
that'll be
very
a show.
American.
It is very American.
You
individual,
know?
Right?
Yeah.
I am. It is me.
And also just like, let's just get to the good stuff.
But it's funny too because did you ever feel this way with stand-up? I always feel like, how is this an entertainment form? It's just like some person, just a person. Like, hey, it's me. Here's my thoughts. Like, that's your night out. Like, you can go see the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It's really wild when you think about it. Like, I'll have that thought sometimes when I'm like in the back of a room just watching someone. Like, they were all just listening to this person and they've somehow met. They just. It does feel like when you watch a stand-up who's doing it over time, they get really good. It's like learning to play music where like they get there, they know the rhythm and they just, I actually felt this when I followed you like 2 years ago here in LA. I really had a hard time following you.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Nothing makes me happier than that.
And you were complaining about how you didn't even want to do the show. But Andrew gave you a ride.
What show? What was that?
This was like fresh out after COVID. Like, I think it was,
yes.
It was just.
Was it at a CrossFit gym?
It was, I think it was at like the Ziggy Hotel.
Yes, I remember. Yes, I remember. Yes, yes.
And the room was pretty tight.
Yes.
But you came on stage and it was just like you, like someone put on a good song.
Oh, that's really nice of
and
you.
And everyone just like fell into it. And they were like, oh, okay, we can enjoy this. And then I went on stage and made a mess of it.
Well, you put on a bad song.
I put on a bad song.
No.
You ever have that happen? You just put on a bad song. I'm sorry.
No, you know, I
tried to jam.
I do remember that show. And I actually remember that I remember your set now that you're mentioning it. And I actually think you're being overly hard on yourself. Because I remember thinking, oh, she's funny. But, you know,
they were mad the whole time I wasn't you. And I was like, I can't help that I'm not him, guys. Go along with me on this or not.
I used to do a line because I always had to follow this one comedian at this one club. Not a comedian I'll be name dropping today on the podcast. But it was like, my first 5 minutes would always be me kind of counseling them on their collective grief that the other guy was no longer on stage.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, okay, well, let's just set. I know you're having a hard time right now with what's happening. I don't have an option. This is, I'm going to be talking
We're
for
here.
15 minutes. We're here. I do have a set. It will be happening.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like when you get in touch with your thing and you can do that. I mean, I have plenty of sets where I am like, oh man, where's my magic? How come I can't play the song?
Yeah.
You know, like I know how to play this instrument and I don't know where it is right now because my ego's involved or because, you know, but when you get, you know, that feeling of like that magic groove that you find.
Oh, that's the best.
It's just the best. And it feels transcendental. And, You know, that's what's interesting about stand-up generally. It's like, you know, I was talking about like, how is this an entertainment form? The one thing we do better than any other entertainment form, because I would posit like watching a big show is like a better total experience. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing is as funny as a stand-up performance when mm-hmm. it's going right. Nothing makes you laugh that hard. Like I love romantic comedies and comedies, and I mean, my favorite movie ever is When Harry Met Sally, you know, and I'll laugh probably 5 times, 10 times in the movie, and mm-hmm. then at the end I go, that was great. You go see Patrice for an hour, if you're not weeping, you have laughed every 5 seconds
yeah.
for the whole, and you too, and me too, like that, it's a fail if it's not like delivering these like regular laughs. That is, I think, the most powerful thing that that comedy can do, is elicit that reaction. Because that's the difference between it and music. You can't really bomb as a musician. You just fill the bombing space with your tinkling sounds. But we got no space to fill. We got to wait.
That's why I fell in love with stand-up. I couldn't believe that there was something I could watch and enjoy that would make me laugh that consistently.
Right.
I'm like, you could put something on that's going to make you laugh? That's nuts.
It is a crazy thing that we go to a stage to elicit a physiological reaction. Not against the will, although some crowds, yes, against the will. But it's like they're there to laugh, but they're not like trying to laugh. You're pulling it out of them. I mean, to me, that's there's something magical about that. It is a superpower. I think, honestly, a lot of this book is about this feeling of superpowers. That, like, the books that I read growing up were all about these, like, weak, powerless kids who thought that they had nothing. Mm-hmm. And then one day something happens or someone shows up and says, actually, you're like the most powerful person in the world, right? Harry Potter, like just come out of the little cubby under the stairs become an activist against the trans community. And you can be like the most powerful wizard in the world.
Yeah.
Oh, Narnia kids, walk into this closet and all of a sudden you're a king. Like,
yeah.
That is the experience that I've had in these universes over and over again, is like someone told me a secret and I discovered that I had way more power and way more magic than I thought that I did. Mm. And that's the kind of experiences that I love.
Whoa. How can we not end on that?
I'm down.
That's so, Subculture Vulture.
It's available right now.
It's available now. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was super fun.